This is the story of the G-Men, the special agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and how they've come to strike fear into the hearts of every criminal in America.
Pick him up.
Don't shoot, G-Men! Don't shoot!
Who are you?
Special agent for the FBI.
The FBI?
Yes, I'd be worried too. The FBI, probably the most famous initials in the world, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. America's legendary and respected law enforcement agency is exactly 100 years old. The FBI, inscribed on copycat baseball hats and T-shirts globally, retains a ubiquitous and iconic brand image that has matured from the original He-Man G-Men of the 30s into today's omnipotent special agents. In this 10-part history, I'll be talking to real G, for government, men, past and present, covering events from the Bonnie and Clyde shoot-'em-up gangster era of the flaming 30s to today's deadly war against post-9/11 terrorists and cybercrooks. I'll be exploring some of the Bureau's triumphs and failures and asking how deserved is its phenomenal reputation. A century ago, America had no effective federal law enforcement agency. The Secret Service handled counter-espionage, the Treasury, some major federal crimes, and then there were the largely ineffective and often disparate state laws to fight burgeoning interstate crime as it spread with the birth of the motor car, the Trans-America Railroad, and the plane. Cops in New York could hardly arrest fleeing villains 3,000 miles away in California. The FBI's own historian, John Fox.
In 1908, the Attorney General needed a national detective force, and he did not have one at his ready command. And so he formed his own detective service out of a handful of people hired from the Secret Service and a number of other investigators. All told, there were 34 special agents in that first force created.
Initially, the Bureau of Investigation, as it was first called, dealt on a federal basis with a mix of criminal violations, some national security concerns, and the new white-collar crimes like land fraud and corruption in federal government. Basically, it was just another government agency with little to distinguish it, nor with the executive energy and authority to confront the new violations from the developing confluence of social, political, and economic factors at the beginning of the 20th century in the United States. Between 1820 and 1920, over 30 million European immigrants arrived, and old America began to fade away.
Here in the cities are the teeming millions of immigrants, the foreign-born and their children, still living much as they did in their homelands. German and Italian, Irish and Greek, French and Pole and Slav and Jew, who came here in the greatest mass migration in history. Here they live in the cities, in the slums, in mine towns and mill towns. Their sons and grandsons are Americans, but sometimes with a difference. Sometimes with a twisted hatred of the system which has kept their fathers poor, and a determination to beat that system.
11 years after the Bureau was formed, America was undergoing the painful contractions of a new nation at birth. There was a real concern that this infant society could even survive, politically, the dangerous cross-infections of mass immigration, alien political ideas, and stressful economic climates. 1919 particularly was a long, scary year. The year after the end of World War I, most of the soldiers had come home to face high unemployment and social unease. There were widespread strikes throughout the nation, and the growing fear of encroaching radicalism, even anarchy. The unions were restless and politically active.
We must remember what happened after World War I in 1919.
This soundtrack is from a pro-union film made by the Congress of Industrial Organizations. It shows demonstrators clashing with police, National Guards, and federal troops in the streets.
Employers mobilize the full power of the government against the unions. Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer said he was after communists. Under cover of red baiting, he and the employers crippled the trade unions.
With the fumes of revolution in the air, in that same year, an act of terrorism was directed against the state, specifically public figures, including the Washington Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer. John Fox.
In the spring of 1919, a series of mail bombs were sent out by an unknown group of terrorists. And when those were intercepted at the post office, they decided to try something else, planting those bombs at the residences of the Attorney General and several other business and political leaders.
This one act, the 9/11 of its time, was to shake the nation's sense of security to its foundations. Author-historian Chris Finan.
The Russian Revolution had occurred just a couple of years before, and it had announced itself as a world revolutionary movement. And Americans believed that this was the beginning of a Bolshevik invasion of the United States, and there were demands for immediate action by the federal government.
These fevered times produced a man whose name was to become synonymous with ruthless and often partial law enforcement, a man destined to become an American icon. John Fox again.
Within the Department of Justice, an intelligence group was created called the General Intelligence Division to look into this threat. A young J. Edgar Hoover, who was an attorney in the department at the time, was put in charge, and it eventually became a part of the Bureau of Investigation.
It was in 1919 that J. Edgar Hoover, then a young lawyer in the Justice Department, wrote the department's first legal study on the newly formed Communist Party.
That archived clip from WGN-TV gives a hint of what was to come. J. Edgar Hoover, a pudgy man with intelligent, unsmiling eyes, set in a broad face with a tight mouth and an ambition that belied his early Mandarin years. His first job had been organizing card files at the Library of Congress, but this filing clerk was already pacing the outer halls of fame. FBI specialist author Burton Hirsch recalls how Hoover really was the right man for the time.
Hoover had assembled himself a card catalog of about 450,000 potential suspects, having a strong bias against Bolsheviks and other non-corporate thinkers. This is the way Hoover worked from the time he was very young till the very end of his life. He was an assembler of information. And he began to round these people up. Most of these people were Russian immigrants and people of socialist convictions, people who had little or nothing to do, certainly nothing to do with the blowing up of Palmer's house.
In the so-called Palmer raids, J. Edgar Hoover was an enthusiastic protagonist.
Well, Hoover was the architect, and he rose to the occasion.
Chris Finan, author of From the Palmer Raids to the Patriot Act, A History of the Fight for Free Speech in America.
Between November 1919 and January 1920, more than 4,000 members of the two American Communist parties were hauled out of bed. They were hauled out of classrooms. They were picked up on the street and thrown into whatever holding areas could be found to hold them.
The Palmer raids were America's first but by no means last Red Scare. Hoover was number two at the Bureau during the shameful and hysterical overreaction of government. All were denied the right to a lawyer, and many detainees were deported before Congress finally stepped in and put a stop to the scandal. Congressional testimony, prepared by Hoover for Palmer, betrayed the views of a somewhat unpolitically correct policeman. "These agitators were vowed revolutionaries," he declared. "Out of the sly and crafty eyes of many of them leap cupidity, cruelty, insanity and crime. From their lopsided faces, sloping brows and misshapen features may be recognized the unmistakable criminal type." This kind of rant should have terminated Hoover's career, but even then he showed a nimbleness that was to serve him well throughout his life. When necessary, and in one bound, he crossed the divide between apparent neo-fascism to staunch defender of civil rights. Burton Hirsch.
I think he was aware that it had smudged his young record, and he wanted to somehow overcome that. And his way, typically, his way of doing that was to approach Roger Baldwin, who was founding the American Civil Liberties Union at that time, and profess himself to be a great civil libertarian. And he and Baldwin remained friends throughout both of their lives.
He could talk liberal to liberals and conservative to conservatives.
Chris Finan.
Roger Baldwin, the head of ACLU, initially saw Hoover actually as an ally, as somebody who could help rein in some of the abuses of civil liberties that were carried out by local law enforcement, by sheriffs and local district attorneys. But Hoover had a great capacity to let people think what they wanted to think and to do what he wanted in any case.
5 years after the Palmer raids, Hoover was offered the top job of director of the Bureau of Investigation. By 1924, the Bureau was seen as an ineffectual and deeply corrupt organization, an insignificant apostrophe of its parent Department of Justice. For all his foxy cunning and insincere conversions, J. Edgar Hoover was nevertheless a quite remarkable man. His brilliant organizational skills, his true convictions and obsessions, his rigidity and clear sense of morality resonated with a frightened and insecure public. A national fear of radicalism lurked in the American DNA, and Hoover shared this gene. His brief, which he was to spend half a century enlarging, was eventually to include the pursuit of federal and interstate criminals, the finding and arrest of foreign spies and their domestic agents, together with a collection of raw intelligence. Unlike Britain's rough equivalent MI5, which has no arrest powers, Hoover's FBI could snoop, investigate, and put the cuffs on suspects. This was heady stuff for the most democratic nation in the world. Author Ronald Kessler has devoted a lifetime study of the FBI and its former director. He explains how the breadth of Hoover's brief dangerously blurred the firewalls between law-breaking criminals and those who merely held political views which were disagreeable to the first boss of the FBI.
In the Palmer raids, Hoover kept index cards with not only the possible criminal activities of people, but also their beliefs, their public statements. And that was an indication of problems to come because he confused, on the one hand, criminal activity with free speech. That really led to tremendous difficulties later in his career. He really turned the FBI into a moral arbiter based on his own sense of morality, and that was not the role of the FBI. The role of the FBI was to investigate crimes, not to dictate to people how they should live their lives.
His excesses tended to be, you know, bureaucratic excesses.
Chris Finan.
He fought to protect his power at all costs, and as a consequence of that, his power grew, and he ultimately had tremendous ability to manipulate people in Washington and to violate civil liberties. But the obsession with communism, I think, never ended.
This, then, was the man destined to become the most powerful unelected civil servant in the history of the United States.
J. Edgar Hoover is the FBI, and that is our story. The story of a man, an organization, and their service to the nation, a story of fidelity, bravery, integrity.